What is up, Crypt Nation? Good citizens of Crypt Nation. I hope everybody is having a great morning, noon, or night. It's about to get a lot better. Today we are joined by the wonderful Shiv Malik, who is the head of communications and marketing at Streamr. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on, taking the time. You're out in London. It is a little late there, but it is my morning, and we're just going to get into Streamr. So what is Streamr? Why should we care?
That's a great question. So we're doing a couple of things. Let me start with the thing that I think that sort of stands out the most, which is we're building a platform for data unions. So, you know, there's been this huge problem in the world at the moment, which is that people go, look, hey, you know, all my data gets sucked up by these huge giants like Google and Facebook and Twitter et al. They sell it on my behalf, and then I end up with, you know, no privacy. And that's a huge problem in the world. And everyone involved in tech kind of knows that's the case. The question is, how do you resolve that issue? Is there a way of actually doing that? Is there a way of owning your data and actually monetizing it right on your behalf? And actually, is that, there's a really good point here, which is that actually, is that the solution? You know, because there are other people who are like, look, you know, we live in a panopticon society. Let's just close down all avenues that kind of lead towards this. You know, just keep everything private. There are others who believe that, you know, all data, no data should be monetized, because, you know, by trying to monetize it, we're kind of ruining really the wider societal benefits. But I believe, I think Streamr believes, and I think the route that hasn't been taken is this other third route, which is you own your data, you sell it, you make money from it. It's been a bit of a shibboleth, technically speaking, as to who can get there. And I think we're there.
Awesome.
So, we can dive into that a bit more if you want.
Yeah, I feel like from doing some research, it looks like the Streamr stack has several different products, just kind of like how Google has search and mail and docs and sheets and slides, right? So Streamr has a host of products. What are the core elements of the Streamr stack?
So we've got the marketplace, which is kind of encompasses this sort of platform for building data unions. So that's the aspect where you can sort of take your data and monetize it, right? And I think, again, on that front, we're seeing the rise of data marketplaces. They're going to have a lot of failures, some successes. Let's see what comes out in the wash on that basis. Then you have this other part, which is a really massively ambitious topic. It's actually what we set out to do in the first place. So if you read our white paper, you'll see it's sort of laid out there, which is to build a network, a pub sub peer-to-peer network for data.
A pub sub?
Yeah, as in publish and subscribe.
Okay.
So that defines a kind of a pattern of how data is distributed between people. And it's a bit like the BitTorrent network. Do you remember the BitTorrent network? I mean, it's still going.
Right? Yeah, it's still very vibrant.
Right. Imagine that network, but made mainly just a bit more for machine data rather than kind of maybe personal messages and that kind of a thing. But also sustainable and monetizable, right? So in essence, you can have other like the Bitcoin network, you can have miners, or in this case, nodes acting with incentives and sort of taking this data from one place to another, right? So at the moment, what's this, you know, what do people use at the moment? You know, every company in the world who works in real time has some kind of backend. Usually it's Amazon Web Service sort of based. And they do all of they push your data for you. Or some people use Apache Kafka, which is kind of this open source software. The problem is that there is no kind of a decentralized solution where it's like almost a cloud-based Amazon sort of service where Amazon isn't right at the heart of this all, doesn't have control of the data, doesn't get a view in into the metadata. So we need a system that, in a sense, just integrates into the internet as it stands at the moment. And we don't have that. That's really important. So that's the other thing that we're building. And then finally, we've got this third thing, which is, you know, every data scientist will know, okay, fine, great. So you've got somewhere to push your data through, which is the network. You've got somewhere to monetize your data if you really want to. But you also need this thing in the middle, which is that you need to just like visualize your data, see what it is, clean it up, maybe attach it to a smart contract, use it to trigger something else, use it to build an oracle, that kind of stuff. Well, that tooling we also provide, and that's called Core.
So, and that one's called Core.
Yeah,
Okay, wonderful. So let's spend some time. I think it's very important to spend some time breaking down the concept of a data marketplace. You know, people might have heard the term, and I think people understand the idea, you know, a lot of the listeners, that, you know, Google takes our data that we produce on the web and all that kind of stuff and monetizes it. So they give us a service for free, and we are the product that they sell for advertisements and stuff. So let's talk about how the future of, you know, data sharing is going to look like with data marketplaces, where we could kind of monetize what we are producing, our digital footprint, if you will.
So in a way, I've seen these kind of, I see these big companies as sort of pirates, right? If you want to join the kind of high seas of communication, you want to email someone, you want to tweet, you want to be on LinkedIn, whatever you want to do in terms of reaching out to others digitally speaking, you have, you know, you're going to be accosted by these pirates at some point or another, who basically put a knife to your throat and say, well, you know, if you want to join the sea, you know, we're going to take your data from you. And that's it. That's the cost of doing this. And I think, you know, people are kind of fed up with this at this point in the cycle.
Why do you think people are fed up with it, you know?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons. Some people realize that, you know, their privacy has been forsaken. And I think those people are actually small in number, but very vocal. Other people realize they're getting a bad deal, and they see the kind of money flowing into Facebook and the power and control that comes with that. And it's not just Facebook, it's Google. You know, Mark Zuckerberg actually gets a lot of unfair press in that respect, because, you know, he sort of led this in many ways, and he is just one face. Whereas, you know, Google and Twitter are no different. And I think there's somewhat more affectionate look towards Jack from Twitter, but, you know, they're all doing the same thing. And I think in that sense, so people have had enough. Either it's from the privacy perspective, the power control perspective, or they want a choice, right? You know, people just want a choice. And they also think, you know, I'm being ripped off in some way, and they don't really understand quite how. And that's that kind of erring sense that, you know, the future just does not look as good as it should do. And in fact, maybe the past was even better. And I think we had a better vision of what the web looked like, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And that's clearly not occurred. And it's not taken place. It's not happened in that vision where individuals were in control.
And so what does a data marketplace really look like? Is it that, like, I'm just trying to conceptualize it.
Yeah. So most people will probably have heard of, like, Bloomberg, right? Like,
right.
He's really rich, right? And how did he get rich? Well, he gets rich because he sold a thing called Bloomberg Terminal. All that is actually is a data marketplace, right? Where there's basically one centralized seller. He sells a lot of financial data. That's what he does. So these things aren't like that strange. Thomson Reuters, people might be familiar with that. Like, they have a huge data marketplace where they sell to lots of different companies. So if you want insights, analytics, you want to know what the weather is like in a particular area, because, you know, that might give you information on crop yields, or it might be that you want to find out what books are selling or not, right? Also, there's huge, vast array of data that's already being sold. Interestingly, the data, but that's usually business to business data, right? That there are established markets for that to an extent.
And that's not the problem you're trying to solve, right? You're trying to solve consumer data, consumer to business?
Well, where the ethical issues come in really are with this kind of social media data. And all that data is being sold in dark markets. You can't really talk to these people and ask, you know, if you go to Facebook and find out like how much it costs to buy X, Y, and Z, it's all very hidden and dark and under the table. You know, and if you want to go to, you know, we didn't even know, for example, that the major US mobile providers were selling people's mobile data. And then when they said that they wouldn't, they still did, right? So all of really deeply shady at best, and unethical at worst, and actually in some cases it's been unlawful. Europe's moved to legislate all of that. So that's the kind of market that I think we want to create data marketplaces for. And the question has been, well, whose data is it, right? Is it, I go to a platform, I create this information. Is it my data, or is it Google's data or Twitter's data, right? Who owns this? And that's what we're trying to solve here.
Okay. So would I say I'm a blockchain developer on EOS or something like that, right? is Streamer a platform that I could call data from to start interacting with on any blockchain, or is it only certain blockchains? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, data is data in a sense. You can, with Streamer, you can, we're sort of blockchain agnostic. We use a payments channel, which is through Ethereum. So we've, you know, because these two things go hand in hand, the delivery of the data and then how you actually pay for it. So we use a ERC-20 token to do all of that. Now, let's just go back to that issue around building a kind of solving this particular problem. So what we've done is created the concept of a data union. And if people know about Jared Lanier and his work and Glenn Weil with Radical Exchange, then they'll get the idea of a kind of, you know, what they call MIDs and what we're calling data unions. Actually, Jared Lanier is the author of a wonderful book, Who Owns the Future, published in 2013. And he just did a thing for the New York Times, so which I'd recommend watching, a three-part video series.
Could we break down the concept real quick of a data union?
What data unions do is basically allow you. Yeah.
Perfect.
So what is a data union? A data union is this from a technical perspective, right? The issue about owning your data has been sort of threefold. One, how do you actually claim ownership and transfer it? So you kind of need a marketplace for that. How do you also get discovery, right? That's also an issue, a technical issue around, again, marketplaces. And the third thing is how do you then get paid for it? And if everyone needs to get paid like a couple of cents a day, a week, then you're talking about micropayments, and then you're going to need a blockchain type solution because the fiat banking system won't do that for you. So we basically combine those three aspects to say, to create a very simple thing where, you know, if let's say you've got data from Spotify, right? So you authorize this data union to, you know, you've seen that, say, sign in with Google, sign in with Twitter. Well, that system is known as the OAuth system. And you can just sign a permission, a third party app, in this case, a data union, to view all that data. They then push that to Streamer, where it creates a huge fire hose of information as a product on our marketplace. The more people that join, the larger that product gets. So we've got a sort of a test run with a Spotify data union, and it's got about 50, 60 people in there just from our community. And it's really fun to watch the kind of fire hose and the canvas, and like you can see what everyone else is playing, right? Yeah. Their playlists and their songs and what time they've played it, right? So it's actually a really useful repository of information already, right?
Amazing.
I can see my song list, I can see the other people's song list and what they play. And people can come along and then buy that, and when they subscribe to it, if you think that's useful information for you, for your business, let's say, you know, you're in the music business, you want to know what people's habits are, great, you buy this, and then as soon as that is bought, it gets distributed, that money gets distributed out in crypto tokens, obviously, to everyone in that data union on an equal basis, largely. So that's it. That's a kind of technical back end of this. So anyone can come along, dev teams can come along. We've already got a couple of them. We've got about 25 people who at the external teams building data unions right now.
So I could theoretically just join any data union. Anybody could join any data union and say, you know, I'm a big Spotify listener, for instance, so I want to join that. So I could contribute my data to that group.
Yeah.
And get paid for it.
Yeah, you can get paid for it and you can join pretty much any, you know, data union you want.
That's
as
amazing.
Long as you're ostensibly generating the data, right? So it's a question of how fast we can, or our community or the developers out there listening to this program can come along and build these data unions, right? Because there's no reason why you can't, in a sense, have one for Twitter, have one for pretty much any social media platform out there. Have one, we've got, you know, people building one for Fitbit right now. There's the one that we're sort of demoing with, because it's the most developed at the moment, is a plugin, a browser. The plugin for both Chrome and Firefox. And it just scoops up the kind of data that you want and you're happy with providing. So there's a sort of, you know, the module system. So you can say, yeah, I'm happy with this. I'm not happy with that. And that's it. You're part of a data union. And as soon as that sells, you'll be making money with everyone else. So it's actually, you know, technically, it's more of a data cooperative, but we're calling them data unions because it's an easier thing to kind of understand.
Yeah. So this is kind of a future where users are taking back control of their identity and their data. And do you kind of see that this is going to be a trend that's unfolding? Like how do you go? I mean, Google, and you know, they're the biggest, you know, one of the biggest companies in the world. Is how are we going to take them down? Are there going to be more platforms like Streamr?
Well, you know, we're kind of agnostic to whatever anyone wants to build. So people can just come and keep building these things on top, right? So we don't need more streamers. We just need more of these data unions. This is the world. Okay, look, so there's some knock-on effects. If this succeeds, if the idea as a meme, if you want, of a data union succeeds, then we get into a really interesting place, right? Because let's say I'm a developer and I want to build my map service, right? Like a Google Maps, but I've got a great idea, X, Y, and Z. Now, what happens now is that you come along and you go, oh my God, I've got to get to 40 million users before I can start to compete with Google, right?
Right.
So that's really difficult, right? So it's a classic sort of network effects issue. If you get there, right, what happens? If you get to 10 million, Google starts to notice you, and what do? Right? They buy you out. Just like with Waze, the nearest competitor to Google is owned by Google.
Yeah.
It's called Waze. Right? So because they got bought out. And what does that mean? Everyone knows what's happening. It's not just Google, it's all the other companies. It just stifles innovation. Now, the laws at the moment don't restrict that because they're all free. So the law goes, well, look, if they're free, then you know, you're not stifling competition because it's all free anyway. But we all know that the innovation that's being stifled, that means you just get the one app and that's it. It's all dominant. Now, if you have a world in which the underlying data set, which is being generated in Google's case by you and me driving around, right, using our phones, if you have that and that is free and open for anyone to subscribe to and buy, that means we live in a world in which the underlying data, people can just come along and build on top of it, right? Build their app on top of it, whatever it might be, and Google can't stop them. And that is exactly how the world should be. I want to have a million apps to choose from and really choose the best and make sure that the innovation as it moves along isn't being stifled or bought up or hindered, right? It's like whoever has the best idea should win. And I want to live in that world.
Yeah.
And we don't live in that world by any means.
So how important, like, do you think privacy is? And in context of this, just basically like people are joining the data union, they are foregoing their privacy. They're saying, "You look, here's my Spotify playlist, or here's my Twitter feed. Here's all my personal information, and you're going to pay me." So in the past, you know, we didn't get our privacy was violated, and we didn't get paid for it. Now we're still opting in to quote unquote, you know, give away our privacy, but we get compensated for it. So is that right? Is that how it works?
Yeah. So what we've done is try to take a privacy first approach, which means, what does that mean? It means that we're encouraging the people who are building these data unions to say, okay, look, give people the control and the options to choose and how much information they want to give, which is a way better situation, of course, than the situation that people are in now, right, where they have no options whatsoever in that respect. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is, I'm going to hold up my hands here and say, I don't know what's going to happen on this basis, which is how will people react, right? We live in a world at the moment where I go, here, look, you know, give me your information. You can use this email service or whatever it might be. And you can use it for free. And you go, that's fine, no problem. Then I say to you, okay, well, how about I give you $10 for that information, right? For the next month. And you will probably turn around and go, no way, right? I'm not telling you my birthday and my address and my credit card information and, you know, what I emailed to my girlfriend last week. I'm not going to give any of that to you for $10. Are you kidding me? And then I turn back and you say, well, you just gave it to me for free. Like, what's your problem? I'm paying you now and you don't want it and you don't want to take the money. So I think there's going to be some cognitive dissonance there. You know, it's a kind of very interesting behavioral economics issue. I think we'll face that. I think data unions will face that. But I also think that that in itself will also generate, you know, the right kind of attitudes in people when they wake up and realize, oh, I've got a choice. Oh, this is worth something. Oh, I don't have to do this, right? And again, even if data unions like don't succeed, but this succeeds where people realize, my privacy is worth something. Brilliant. In a sense, we'll have added to the world, though commercially may have failed. Like, that's still a win for me in some senses. But I, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. And I think there's, you know, there's a big cultural shift going to take place because of this.
So fascinating. I completely agree. I think there's going to be a huge cognitive dissonance. And I love that point that you said, like, you know, people, people don't think about it. I feel like people will think like they're, you know, not to be crude here, but they'll feel like they're prostituting themselves out. Whereas now they're prostituting themselves out and they don't even realize it. And so now when you attach a dollar value to it, they're like, oh, well you're going to pay me for all this really personal information. Well, I don't want to do it. And it is like such a gnarly cognitive dissonance, but it's going to be a societal shift like over, you know, 5, 10, 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, think about it this way, right? Imagine going up to someone and you man a stall in a mall, right? And you're giving away, you know, $10 in whatever it is, like vouchers, right? For a shop,
right?
For Walmart, right? Or whatever it might be. And you say to someone, hey, can you just give me your address and your birth date and your full name and your zip code?
Where you grew up and, you know, what high school you went to and da da da.
And here's this $10, right? And people go, who the hell are you? Stop stalking me. That's crazy, right? Now, just flip that question around, right? Say, hey, look, do you want $10? Oh, and by the way, do you mind filling out this form with some information, right? And they'll probably go, yes, right? We're all kind of very habituated to kind of just giving away this stuff for free. And it's a question of how you flip those questions around. And we've all had that second question put to us like time and time again, and we keep losing, right?
Right. And what's also crazy is people just don't realize that every time you go swipe your credit card somewhere, for instance, all that data that we just talked about, you know, all that personal information is getting transmitted to all these different financial institutions, and, you know, all these different people are selling your information. So people don't even realize what's happening. You go, you swipe your credit card and you're giving all that information and you're paid for a product that you're buying.
Yeah. Can I buy some chewing gum or a bottle of water in a store without telling that store my intimate details of my life? Like,
no,
we used to be able to do that. Right. Not if you use a credit card, right? That's why people are like, we must use cash. But like, I want the convenience, but I don't want to give away my privacy. And you don't even know you're doing it, right? So there we go.
I think we're actually trending towards a cashless society. You know, cash is always, you know, it's a bearer instrument. You bring it with you. Nobody asks questions, unless you're depositing a large sum at a bank. Nobody asks, where'd you get that $100 or whatever, right? And so I think, and it's really hard to trace cash as well. There's very limited traceability to cash. And so I kind of foresee a future where we're not going to have cash, and that's not going to be an option because cash is too powerful as a medium of exchange in this day and age, you know, as privacy preserving. So, you know, you already see countries like China moving in this direction with Alipay and WeChat Pay, where every single transaction is totally monitored and totally mapped. But I mean, what are your views on cashless society in the next 10 years or not?
I mean, here's the experiment that I just did in a sense, like I went to Japan and they use cash for just so much, pretty much everything. You have to have cash on you all the time. I had to pay someone, I think, you know, $800 just upfront in cash, like again, or like $1,500, like, because they wouldn't accept anything. They just, you know, wouldn't accept credit cards, like not a thing. And it's really inconvenient. I guess you can, you know, it's like living in London, like, you know, everything's contactless, right? In America, you're still like signing stuff,
right?
Which I find like incredibly archaic. I'm like, please, just like, I just want to touch it and go. So, convenience is king. And the problem is that it also means, you know, giving up on your privacy in many senses. And people will always, it seems, the trend is, in terms of billions of people, they will sacrifice their privacy for an extra 15 seconds or 5 seconds of life, right?
Yeah.
On their terms, which is crazy, but there we go. So how do we flip that around? Again, I think waking people up through the activity of owning your data, right? This is the thing. So it's a sort of a little crazy. If you want to actually own your data, like, what does that mean? We don't have any of the infrastructure set up. Like, if I said, okay, hey, like, you want to sell your house? Okay, but there's no estate agents. That you don't know the price of your neighbor's house or anyone in your neighborhood. No one sold a house before.
Right.
And, oh, and by the way, there's no like monetary system you can use, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in that world, I ask you, hey, how much is your house worth? And like, why haven't you sold it already? And you're like, well, you know, I've got to create estate agencies, right? Like, you know, I need a realtor, God damn it. So in a sense, we're at that level with selling your and owning your data. Like, you've got to have like ownership is only meaningful if you have all of these other things to realize a transfer of that ownership. And so that's that, you know, that's why people have lagged as individuals behind big companies. You know, big companies trade information all the time, but there is no infrastructure for individuals to be able to do it. And that's why I think what Streamr is doing is so massively important. You know, again, we might end up not winning out and beating other people, but we're definitely a leader in this. And I love the fact that that's the case.
Hey, Crypt Nation, real quick interruption from our wonderful sponsors over at eToro. If you guys haven't had a chance to check them out yet, I mean, we talk about them every day. You guys should really go check them out. Just go to crypto101podcast.com/eToro. And Pete, why don't you tell them about them? What is eToro?
It's one of the easiest ways to buy and sell crypto with confidence, first of all. They've been around since 2007. All the assets they have on there have been looked at really, really well. It's legal in over 140 countries and trusted by over 10 million users. So if you're not one of them, why?
Yeah, seriously, you got to be asking yourself that question. And, you know, they've been around since 2007. They started trading crypto assets in 2013. So these cats are the real freaking deal. And my favorite aspect about it is that it's so beginner friendly and it's so expert friendly, but they give you this $100,000 virtual trading simulator so you can practice, you know, executing trades and, you know, technical analysis and all that kind of stuff before you actually put your money where your mouth is. So that's my favorite aspect of the whole thing.
My favorite aspect is how easy it is to sign up. I didn't have to wait days for KYC to be approved or anything like that. Literally within 2 minutes, I was able to use my account.
Yeah, it's nuts. Anyhow, guys, as you know, not all platforms are created equal. So go ahead, check it out for yourself. And then hit us with a DM and let us know what you guys think. All right, back to the show.
I'm going to switch gears here just a little bit. I'm kind of curious to get your take on Bitcoin. What do you think of Bitcoin? Because it has a lot of the same properties that you're talking about, you know, in owning your own data, right? Stuff like that. And, you know, maintaining financial privacy that, you know, you could have a Bitcoin address that's not tied to any of your personal information. But just kind of at a high level, you know, what's your take on Bitcoin?
I'm more of an Ethereum man. And, you know, I like the difference between the more libertarian Bitcoiners, you know, and a lot of them are high libertarians, right? So, they're all about privacy, but they're also about self-sovereignty. But also self-sovereignty in the political space, like hard political space, right? I'm an individual, like this is my, I own this land, get off. And, you know, they're often get confused with the gun crowd as well, right? I'm more of an Ethereum person in the sense that, like, there's a guy called Wendell Davis who said something on stage at the last DevCon 4. He said, like, you know, we're building tools for human coordination. And I see myself coming from that space. I wrote a book back in 2020. Called Jilted Generation. It's all about economics and the kind of millennial generation not being able to have as good an economic life as their parents, right? And I think we've seen some of that play out with kind of housing and rents and the job market and pensions, right? And that got me thinking about cooperative methods in economics. And I think Ethereum really is proving to be far more interesting to me anyway, at least at that level. And, you know, Bitcoiners and Ethereum people sometimes get on. More often than not, they kind of, you know, they'll start scrapping, especially on Twitter. But I'm definitely in the Ethereum scene. I love those guys. I love the whole, I'm definitely in Ethereum through and through.
That's awesome. That's typically an opinion that we don't get very much here on Crypto 101. So I very much like that stance that you take there. Well,
Don't at me.
Snap my fingers in a Z formation. So let's hop back to Streamr real quick. You know, how do you guys make money? How is there a business behind this? You guys take a cut. What's the business model?
I think like most open source projects is a question of like, you know, adoption. If you want to use the technology that we've created in terms of the data unions, you know, the more data unions there are, the more people there are, well, the more that you have to use data coin and data tokens to be able to perform those payment functions. Great. So that's one aspect of adoption. But also when we get the network, actually the network has been launched now, just a couple of days ago, actually.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So we're on the first step and we haven't built in the incentivization layers yet. But people can use it now. It's decentralized. There are, I think, two nodes. So we're building that out, but there's no incentivization for nodes to join yet. And so it's only trusted nodes and trusted parties who are inviting in at this stage. But we're getting there. We've got about another year and a half of development or so. And that's another aspect to Datacoin's use.
Awesome. So you were just at DevCon, I remember you mentioned. And could you give us a little bit of insider insight into ETH 2.0? What is your take on that? How's it coming along? You are Mr. ETH.
So I won't speak to the purely technical aspects because I'm not qualified to do so, but I will speak on the kind of governance issues. And it's something that has plagued, I think, all major networks, right? And what do we mean by governance? It's like, okay, once you've got your chain up, and you know, Bitcoiners will know this too, how do you collectively take decisions when there are no centralized parties to, in the end, defer to? And no one wants centralized parties. Fine, great, in control. So how do people take decisions like this, right? And if it's just a question of, well, I've got the most tokens, therefore my vote corresponds to, you know, to that, then you end up with some kind of plutarchy, oligarchy situation. And, you know, you run through all of these issues. You know, people, is it just one person, one vote? I mean, leaving civil attacks kind of aside, then, you know, how on earth do you kind of get that up off the ground? And why should, like, you know, someone who's been using, you know, the Bitcoin network or the Ethereum network for like 7 seconds, like, get a say in how it runs? So there's all of these issues. And the worst part is that once you have a network up and running and it is actually adopted, then trying to build in like governance afterwards, like in a post hoc fashion, is really hard. And I've sat in those meetings, a number of them, with some really, you know, vested players, and you can't get them to agree. You know, I was going to compare it to Brexit, being in Britain, but it turns out that just today, as we're recording, they've actually agreed a deal. So Brexit may turn out to be easier than. Yeah, they just, no, not in Parliament, but the European Union and the British government have agreed another deal. Yeah.
Wow.
So it may turn out that Brexit was easier than building Ethereum or Bitcoin governance. God help us all.
you're feeling pretty good about ETH 2.0. Is that right?
Well, no, as in a sense, to conclude, the governance aspects, I think, are going to plague whatever comes next. I think it was pretty quiet and subdued in many respects on actually what's going to happen on ETH 2.0. You know, last year was in Prague, was at DevCon 4, was far more bullish. I think that's kind of died down. So it felt like there was, you know, this grittiness to whether this would actually happen. And people weren't sure. And I think the next 6 months are probably going to be very crucial in telling whether this is going to happen or not. And if it doesn't, I think there's going to be major issues with the Ethereum network. You know, there are thousands and thousands of developers. It clearly is the most popular network in terms of attracting developers. And they can't just, you know, offload to somewhere else. But they're going to have to, obviously, if we don't get ETH 2.0.
Yeah. We always talk about, you know, FUD, right? Fear, uncertainty, doubt. It sounds like we're really in that uncertainty period with Ethereum, but, and price is obviously reflecting that. But, you know, if we get it out, if we see the light at the end of the tunnel, we make it, I think there's a lot of upside for this network because, as you said, it is far and away the most actively developed platform in the crypto space. And if Ethereum went down, we would all be having a bad time. If Ethereum went down, we would go far below even $100 billion market cap for the entire space. I'm bullish
absolutely.
Yeah. I'm absolutely bullish on Ethereum and all the, you know, you got some of the smartest guys in the world, you know, obviously Vitalik and Vlad and Aditya building, you know, some really, really smart protocols. So they have my best wishes And, you know, they're in my thoughts and prayers every day. And I hope they're in everybody's thoughts and prayers.
Yeah.
So, man, real quick, just in closing, I just got a couple last questions for you. These are some fun questions that we just like to ask everybody that comes on the show. Just adds a little bit of color to the whole thing. So if you had to choose one company in the crypto space, besides Streamer, of course, that was making the most substantial impact, what would you say it would be?
You know, Bryce, I was preparing to for you to ask me about people. Do you want me to answer the one about companies?
Yeah, take your time. Feel free. There's no rush.
So look, I love Colony.
Colony?
Yeah. So they're in the kind of, yeah, they're in the DAO space. And okay. Their development is kind of, they just pushed out their sort of first version, if you want. And it's a kind of pro forma DAO for running organizations. So it's pretty simple to use. It's not quite as complicated maybe as Aragon. And Aragon allows you to do lots of other different things, but this allows you to do just one simple thing well. And the pattern is, hey, you go to work. So if you're going to run your workspace as a DAO, like what would that look like? And that's what it is. It's pretty beautiful. I love the team. Oren is great. Daniel is also, they're lovely. They're really lovely guys, and they're smart, and they know what they're doing. And actually Oren, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but he was also part of the DAO. So, you know, there's some veterans from that time. And when I say a part of, I mean like a real, real part of, like not just like a participant in. So, you know, I love the team and I'm really looking forward to them developing more and more.
Amazing. So yeah, guys, if you guys are listening, you guys don't know what a DAO is. It's DAO, Decentralized Autonomous Organization. It's ways to structure pseudo companies that are self-regulating and stuff. So we should probably do a deep dive on that in one of these episodes here, because they're going to change the way that, you know, businesses are governed and stuff. But Shiv, last question, since you're so well prepared for this, I would feel bad if I didn't ask you. Who do you admire in this space? Who really inspires you? Who is somebody that has maybe left a really big impression on you?
Ooh, so three people. Lane Reddick, who's an Ethereum developer and has a big thing about governance. I really love what he's been saying on that front, although we don't always agree. I love, because I think you can't not love, Maria Paula from Golem, MP, as she's known to most people, because she's just so energetic and active on almost every front.
I'd appreciate an introduction to her so that we could get her on the pod. We love high energy folk.
Yeah, she's awesome. She's really awesome. She's everywhere all the time.
I love also Golem too.
Yeah, and Ashley Tyson from Web3 is also similar in that sense, like just a big energy powerhouse in terms of getting stuff done. And finally, I know I said three, but now it's four, Tor Bear. I think he's just awesome. He's so lovable, but also really smart, just really smart and really humble. He's from Enigma. He's the head of growth. He does a great podcast as well. He's worth listening to.
Amazing. Yeah. That's perfect. Those are great. We're going to tag them in this. Hopefully they listen all the way through so that they could hear their shout outs.
Great. I love them all.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Shiv, for taking the time today. As everybody could probably realize, Pizza Mind is still out sick. Poor chap. But he will be back for the weekly fire, no doubt in my mind. And guys, if you guys want to stay in touch with Shiv, go ahead and follow him on Twitter. And what's the Twitter handle?
It's at Shiv Malik.
At Shiv Malik, easy peasy. And what's Streamer's Twitter?
At Streamer, so without the ER at the end.
So it's Streamr, no E.
That's right.
Okay, perfect. Well, man, thank you so much for taking the time, and we will see you soon.
Thanks for having me, man. It was really enjoyable.
Absolutely.